Inequality comes to typical town USA. Clinton and company would have done well to pay attention to what was going on in Decatur, Illinois, a prairie town of homegrown hamburger stands, WPA murals, and numerous statues of Abraham Lincoln, a local boy who made good. During World War II, Decatur was so exactly the quintessence of who we are that it scored 99 out of 100 on an East Coast professor's most typical scale. That professor proceeded to send the then-unknown sociologist C. Wright Mills to Decatur to study its completely average population. What Mills found in Decatur later became the nucleus of White Collar, his famous study of the middle-class mind. Mills should have stuck around a little longer. Shortly after the Clinton administration took office, this most average of American cities descended into class war, with industrial actions at three different local factories. It all started in 1993 when the managers of a Decatur corn processing plant owned by the Tate and Lyle multinational sweetener concern locked out their unionized employees. Contract negotiations had been going nowhere. The union was upset about what they saw as unsafe working conditions in the plant, and management was demanding concessions that were so extreme. For example, they wanted to put the workers on 12-hour rotating shifts in place of the conventional 8-hour day, demands that were so extreme that they seemed designed to provoke a strike. Instead, the union members launched a campaign in which they worked exactly as they were instructed to work by managers and operating manuals, no more, no less. Production declined. Management responded by bringing in replacement workers to do their jobs. Shortly after the lockout began, the unions representing workers at Decatur's Firestone tire plant and its Caterpillar earth-moving factory also went on strike. Here, too, the 12-hour shift was an issue, in addition to two-tier pay scales in which new employees would never be able to earn as much as those who had hired in previously. These were no ordinary concessions. As I learned when I went to Decatur in 1994, a worker's internal clock never adjusts to a rotational system in which your shift moves all the time. More ominously, the 12-hour rotating shift system would make it impossible for workers to participate in the life of their family or town. No more league sports or church choirs for them. The three union locals in Decatur quickly made common cause with one another, and before long a big part of the working population in that most typical American town were out protesting. With billboards, placards, newsletters, and the other publicity tools of that pre-internet era, these aggrieved Midwesterners reached out across the country to tell the story of how their town had become a war zone, by which they meant to suggest that working-class Americans were in the crosshairs of a merciless new economic order. The workers turned out to be right about the war zone. Before long, the local police escalated the conflict with a spectacular bit of violence, using pepper spray on a crowd of peaceful protesters at the Tate and Lyle factory gate. I lived in Chicago at the time, and I remember being shocked by the pictures of that incident, in particular by a poignant one of a middle-aged protester holding an American flag as the pepper spray hit his face. That detail was fairly typical. The union members in Decatur grew increasingly radical as time went on, but they always took care to start their meetings with the Pledge of Allegiance. And those meetings themselves. It's painful to recall how earnestly those people believed in democracy, how deeply they seemed to feel that if average Americans could just get together and talk it over and settle on a plan, why, they could take on multinational corporations. Solidarity would prevail over everything. It was like something out of Lincoln's time, or Roosevelt's anyway. What I remember above all, what I will never forget, is a march I observed in October 1994, that passed by Decatur's three affected factories. 7,000 people from all over the region had come to the war zone to participate, and I climbed up onto an overpass at one point to look back at the parade. The street was filled from side to side and as far as the eye could see with an advancing multitude of workers and average citizens. Even the police had given up trying to exert control by this point. And as I beheld all this, I experienced a spontaneous apprehension of what liberalism was all about, of what it stood for, and of where its power came from. Or rather, where its power used to come from. According to company management, the real problem was that employees were in denial. "The union still thinks it is 1950, declared the CEO of Caterpillar. Those aggrieved Midwesterners simply hadn't understood how the world had changed, how savage the competitive environment had become, and how ridiculous it was now for working-class people to expect to live middle-class lives. It's something CEOs still say, incidentally, about anyone who expects to be paid decently." The Democratic administration in Washington, meanwhile, did virtually nothing to remedy the situation in the Midwestern war zone. Robert Reich had actually wondered in a 1993 interview with the New York Times whether the traditional union is necessary for the new workplace. The union workers themselves had a grittier and, as it turned out, far more accurate impression of where events were taking us. At a contentious union meeting in 1994, I was talking with a bunch of people about the labor struggles of times past, and a locked-out worker at Tate & Lyle named Royal Plankenhorn told me this: "Now it's our turn. And if we don't do it, then the middle class as we know it in this country will die. There will be two classes, and it will be the very, very poor and the very, very rich." Yuppie crimes. But Decatur was far away from Washington, and its problems made no impression that I could detect on Bill Clinton's wise brain trust. The new economy was dawning, creativity was triumphing, old industry was evaporating, and those fortunate enough to be among the ascendant were absolutely certain about the direction history was taking. How could they be so certain? How did the liberal class know so confidently that education and training were the solution for inequality as well as the explanations for individual and national success? Their certainty came, for one thing, from the fact that just about everyone was repeating the same platitudes. Post-industrialism, globalization, the information superhighway. These were gods before whom everyone bowed back then, deities who made their will known to the country's opinion columnists and management theorists. Another reason so many were convinced so completely that education determined everything from personal prosperity to national competitiveness was, again, that it was true for them personally. Going to fancy colleges is what had allowed them to succeed, what had defined them as a generation, what had kept them out of trouble in Vietnam. It was natural for them to think that it could do the same for all people at all times, in all situations. Consider the new president's own story. Higher education had been what opened the doors for Bill Clinton, what had allowed a talented commoner from a backward place to travel the wide world and to enter the highest circles of the power elite. And so it was with nearly all Clinton's close confidants. They were successful professionals whose worth was established by their achievements in college or graduate school. Martin Walker, the journalist who wrote "The President We Deserve," starts his biography by marveling at Clinton's different circles of well-graduated friends, the ones from his college days at Georgetown, the ones from his days as a Rhodes Scholar, the ones from Yale Law School, and then he speculates about the kind of high-powered synergies that could happen when Bill brought one group of smart friends into contact with another. Clinton's cabinet was a kind of yuppie Woodstock, a gathering of the highly credentialed tribes. Critics at the time tallied up how many of them had attended this institution and how many that, how many were married to important journalists and how many were married to important college professors. It was such a tight little network of enlightened strivers, all these hard-working, well-graduated people who not only knew the answers, but who knew one another, too. "The Clinton administration was to fulfill Cecil Rhodes's dream," wrote the British journalist Walker. "Seldom has any foreign country been run so completely by such a narrowly defined elite." Clinton had famously promised to appoint a cabinet that would look more like America than any previous administration. Look like us they did. Black, white, brown, male, female. Examined from any perspective other than their external appearances, however, they were not representative at all. In 1992, the Democratic Convention had laughed at George H.W. Bush's posh boy entourage for being ignorant of life as it's lived in some Appalachian hollow, and now came the news that there were more millionaires among the populist Bill Clinton's cabinet than there had been in Bush's. In addition, more than three-quarters of them were lawyers. The country had merely exchanged one elite for another, a cadre of business types for a collection of high-achieving professionals. One point where Clinton's obliviousness to the situation of ordinary people became conspicuous was in the brief tussle over his first choice for attorney general, one Zoe Baird, a typically well-connected corporate lawyer who was married to a famous law professor at Yale. Between the two of them, Baird and her husband made more than $650,000 per year, but still they saw fit to pay their two undocumented domestic servants a little more than $250 a week, without having initially made the required Social Security payments. Had Baird been a Bush appointee, this would no doubt have constituted a living lesson in how class and inequality work, a teachable moment, as people like to say. But of course it wasn't that at all. It was scarcely anything. The Clinton vetting team wasn't put off by it in the least. They thought it was just a yuppie crime, the columnist Clarence Page joked. Offensive to you, maybe. But in the circles in which these people traveled, it was about as dreadful as the rule-breaking fun of Ferris Bueller and his pals. Congress did not find it so petty, however, and the Baird nomination had to be withdrawn. Bill Clinton was often described as the leader of his generation, but it's more accurate to say he was the leader of a particular privileged swath of his age group, the leader of a class. And this was the moment for his cohort to take their turn at the controls. As the sentimental music of Judy Collins played, one privileged group was taking over from another. A few journalists got it at the time, looking over the rosters of Clinton appointees, their spouses, and their interlocking circles of friends. Jacob Weisberg of the New Republic fretted about the increasingly cozy relationships between press, law, academia, and government that he saw there. There's rarely been a time, he concluded, when the governing elites in so many fields were made up of such a tight, hermetic, and incestuous clique. There was something else Weisberg understood in those early days of the administration. The Clinton circle has a pronounced class consciousness that tells them they're not just lucky to be here, he wrote. They're running things because they're the best.